content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the August 15, 2014 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Fear grows as Africa's Ebola outbreak spreads. What happened? Two Americans were infected who were infected with Ebola while treating patients in Liberia arrived in the U.S. for treatment this week amid mounting concern that the virus outbreak in West Africa is spreading out of control. More than 900 of the 1,700 people infected in Africa have died, and aid agencies have warned of a lack of resources to stop its spread. U.S. Christian missionaries Dr. Kent Brantley and Nancy Reitbold were flown to Atlanta, where they were admitted to a special isolation unit at Emory University Hospital. Both patients received an untested experimental drug while still in Liberia. Tom Frieden, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, assured Americans that Ebola is not easily transmitted and that an outbreak in this country was highly unlikely. "The most important thing we can do to protect Americans," he said, "is to stop this disease at the source in Africa." The outbreak began in the southern forest of Guinea in March and has since spread to Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Nigeria. Symptoms of the virus, which is contracted through bodily fluids and can kill up to 90% of people infected, include fever, vomiting, and massive internal and external bleeding. The World Bank has allocated $200 million in emergency assistance for the nations affected, and the World Health Organization met this week to decide whether to declare a global health emergency. "This outbreak is moving faster than our efforts to control it," said WHO head Margaret Chan. "If the situation continues to deteriorate, the consequences could be catastrophic." What the editorial said: "The deadly mutating viral disease has become the staple of Hollywood horror," said TheGuardian.com. "And Ebola's nightmare symptoms, victims essentially drown in their own blood, can easily cause public panic. But unlike SARS and other highly contagious respiratory illnesses, Ebola is spread by direct contact with bodily fluids such as blood or vomit and is thus relatively hard to catch. Nevertheless, stopping the spread of the worst Ebola outbreak in history will be an enormous challenge," said BloombergView.com. "Air travel increases its potential reach. Many of those infected have been hiding from health workers, and the bereaved have ignored warnings that washing corpses before burial is a common cause of infection. Western nations must aggressively fund experienced teams of health workers from Africa to treat the infected and stop the virus's spread. This Ebola epidemic is different. Unless resources are mustered to bring it under control, it's going to kill many more people in Africa and beyond." What the columnist said: "Who invited Ebola to Atlanta?" asked Ford Vox, also in BloombergView.com. "The two American missionaries deserve the best medical care possible, but their needs must be weighed against the small but catastrophic risk that the virus might spread in the U.S. Couldn't doctors have just set up a field hospital in Liberia that was stocked with the crucial element of a modern intensive care unit? That would never match the state-of-the-art treatment facility at Emory," said Celine Gounder in Reuters.com. "And the chances of the disease spreading from the hospital's special isolation unit, one of only four in the U.S., are close to zero. Even if the virus somehow infected someone else, America's health infrastructure is sufficiently robust to prevent its spread." Ebola will almost certainly remain an African disease, said Stephen Hoffman and Julia Belluz in Vox.com. Scientists have made great strides toward finding both a vaccine and a cure. But because those affected are among the poorest people in the world, pharmaceutical companies see no profit potential in funding research. In fact, more money goes into fighting baldness and erectile dysfunction. But now that the West is threatened, that may change. In the end, it's not Ebola we should fear, said Scott Z. Burns in Time.com. It's the human inability to make sound risk assessments. We react mainly to the monster we can see: terrorists, extreme weather, foreign dictators, known diseases. But every day, migratory birds, bats, and humans cross international borders, and one day they will carry mutated viruses far more infectious than Ebola. Beware of the monster in the microscope. A second main story we have: ISIS takes on the Kurds. Militants with the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria seized control of at least three towns in northern Iraq this week after driving out Kurdish security forces, further expanding their self-proclaimed Islamic State, a swath of territory stretching from western Syria to eastern Iraq. Humanitarian agencies said that 200,000 civilians, mostly from the minority Yazidi community, whose religion predates Islam, had fled the fighting, heading for the mountains. "We've seen what they've done to people of their own faith," said one Yazidi refugee. "Imagine what they would do to us non-Muslims." Fighters from Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdish region, backed by Iraq's Air Force, launched a counteroffensive to retake their towns and protect the nearby Mosul hydroelectric dam, the country's largest source of electricity and water. News from northern Iraq sounds ominously like intelligence alerts that preceded al-Qaeda's attack on September 11, 2001, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. "For now, ISIS is killing mainly Syrians and Iraqis, but left unchecked, it is likely to spread until it threatens Europe and America too." ISIS could be sowing the seeds of its own destruction, said Max Boot in CommentaryMagazine.com. Moderate Sunnis cheered on the group as it battled the repressive Shiite-dominated government, but they're starting to chafe under the jihadist rule, which has seen ancient Islamic monuments destroyed and scores of civilians executed for minor violations of Sharia law. Yet Sunnis will successfully rise up only if they have strong outside support. If the West doesn't intervene quickly, we will soon be hearing about Iraq, the same message we've been getting on Syria. The situation is so grim, there is nothing we can do. Which is why it's time for the U.S. to set aside its One Iraq strategy, said Dexter Filkins in TheNewYorker.com. We should start arming the Kurds, the one group trying hardest to resist ISIS. Despite the risks that they may later use our weapons to further break from Baghdad, what other choice is there? Over on the briefing page, the origins of the border crisis. Why have more than 57,000 Central American children shown up at the U.S. border? Where are the migrants from? El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. Until recently, most people crossing the Mexican border illegally into the U.S. were Mexicans looking for work. But in the past 2 years, the net migration from Mexico has become essentially zero. That's partly because Mexico's economy has improved. At the same time, the government crackdown on drug gangs there has finally eased the violence. Unfortunately, the success of Mexico's crackdown and another war on drugs in Colombia has shifted some of the trafficking business to El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, where it has fueled the growth of violent gangs. Gangs now run entire towns, murder and rape almost at will, and force families and businesses to pay protection money. For many people, the choice is to flee or to die, said Carlos Paz, a charity director in Honduras. Who are these gang members? Most of them were deported from the U.S. Beginning in the late 1990s, a new U.S. immigration law provided for non-citizens, even longtime residents with green cards, to be deported if they committed any kind of crime. Authorities began using the policy to crack down on Los Angeles street gangs, particularly MS-13, a tough gang started by Salvadorans that included Hondurans and Guatemalans, and MS-18, an originally Mexican gang that recruited Central Americans. More than 100,000 of these gang members were deported from 2001 to 2010 on the planes made famous in the movie Con Air. Many had come to the U.S. as small children, and when they were sent back to their home countries, they had few connections and no prospects. So they banded together in criminal gangs with tactics and ruthlessness they learned on the streets. This American style of gangsterism was imported like a catalyst, said Al Valdez, former head of the gang unit for the district attorney in Orange County, California. It took off like a wildfire, like a virus out of control. What is life like there now? The new gangs are dealing arms and drugs and engage in widespread extortion, demanding payments from local businesses and individuals. Those who do not comply are murdered, tortured, or raped. The weak and corrupt governments of these three countries simply couldn't cope with the new breed of organized crime, and police were co-opted or cowed into submission. In El Salvador, children as young as 7 are forced to work as lookouts or couriers for gangs, and they are killed if they refuse. Honduras now has the highest murder rate in the world, and San Pedro Sula, where most Con Air flights landed, is the world's most violent city, with a murder rate of 187 per 100,000. The U.S. rate is 5 per 100,000. How did the exodus begin? People came to believe it was safer to risk an illegal journey over hundreds of miles than to stay. So smugglers known as coyotes began doing big business trafficking Central Americans across borders. Last fall, they began spreading rumors that any child who made it across the U.S. border would be automatically granted asylum. The story was rooted in a kernel of truth. Under a law passed by Congress and signed by President Bush in 2008, unaccompanied children from Central America can't be deported without a hearing, and that process usually takes at least a year. Another source of the rumors was President Obama's 2012 executive order ending the deportation of young illegal immigrants who'd been living in the country for at least 5 years. As a result of the rumors, Central Americans who had already migrated to the U.S. began paying coyotes to bring their kids to them. Parents still living in Central America began rushing to send their kids north now, before the U.S. changed its policy. What is being done in Washington? Not much thus far. The Obama administration has asked Congress for $3.7 billion in extra funds to house about 57,000 children temporarily and hire more immigration officers and staff to process their request to stay. The White House says most of the migrants would not qualify for humanitarian relief under the 2008 law and would be deported once they have hearings. House Republicans refused to act on Obama's requests and before leaving for their August recess, passed a bill last week that would change the 2008 law so that Central American children could be sent back quickly. The bill has no chance of passing the Senate or becoming law. The impasse leaves the migrants in legal limbo, and the U.S. with no coherent policy for dealing with the exodus from Central America. Our controversy of the week, immigration. Republicans say, hell no to border kids. Deport them all. That phrase, said Steve Bannon in MSNBC.com, neatly summarizes the immigration legislation House Republicans finally passed this week before rushing away on their August recess. As time ran out, Speaker John Boehner pressed the House to do something about the crisis on our southern borders that's left 57,000 Central American migrant children in legal limbo. When angry GOP hardliners scuttled every moderate proposal, a desperate Boehner let such anti-immigrant Tea Party loonies as Michelle Bachmann and Steve King draw up a bill of their dreams. The bill guts the 2008 human trafficking law that guaranteed asylum hearings to minors fleeing violence in Central America. Even worse, it also overturns Obama's 2012 executive order allowing children brought here by illegal immigrants at least 5 years ago, the so-called Dreamers, to stay in the country. The House's Hell No bill will never pass the Senate, said the New York Times in an editorial. So now it's President Obama's job to solve the crisis at the border and protect millions of other immigrant children from deportation. The liberal media is trying to spin this as another tale of Republican dysfunction, said Jennifer Rubin in the WashingtonPost.com. But the House did pass immigration legislation. The Democratic-controlled Senate, by contrast, beat a hasty retreat out of town without passing anything. Last week's bill, moreover, established an important principle by reimbursing states for the cost of sending National Guard units to the border. Once the border security first concept is enshrined at the heart of any new laws, even hardline conservatives will accept issuing work visas and legal status, though not citizenship, to the 11 million undocumented immigrants already here. That's not how it looks to voters, said the Wall Street Journal. By succumbing to their anti-immigrant extremist, Republicans have sent the country a signal that their highest policy priority is to deport as many children as possible back from wherever they came. Such gleeful callousness is going to alienate many conservatives, never mind minority voters. The sheer political illogic of what Republicans just did is staggering, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. The party's official postmortem on 2012's lost presidential election concluded that the party's future depended on making inroads with Hispanics, the nation's fastest-growing demographic bloc. Now, less than 2 years later, 216 House Republicans, including such plausible presidential candidates as Representative Paul Ryan, just went on record for a policy most Latino voters consider disqualifying. The confusion of House Republicans on immigration is a sad story, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. But President Obama's response is far more alarming. He's now promising to issue an executive order that would give some form of amnesty to many of the 11 million illegal immigrants currently living in the U.S. This extraordinary abuse of office would invite more illegal immigration and open Obama to a legitimate threat of impeachment. The president's frustration is understandable, said the Washington Post. Congress is obstinate, hopelessly partisan, and incapable of problem solving. But this is a nation of laws, and Obama can't fix the immigration mess by issuing royal edicts. Yes, he can ensure that the Central American children are treated humanely and given due process, but if he's thinking of issuing a blanket amnesty to them or the 11 million immigrants already here, the president should think twice. Well, it was a good week for believing after a Russian fisherman being mauled by a brown bear escaped death when the Justin Bieber song Baby started playing on his phone, causing the beast to flee. I know that sort of ringtone isn't to everyone's taste, said Igor Voroshbitskin, age 42. It was a good week for millennials after Merriam-Webster's official Scrabble Players Dictionary, which hasn't been updated in decades, added 5,000 new words that can be played on the Scrabble board, including selfie, bromance, and chillax. Gratitude. It was a good week for gratitude after a diner in North Carolina began offering 15% discount to anyone who prays or takes a moment of to meditate before eating a meal. Being grateful opens the heart chakra, said restaurant owner Mary Hagland. It was a bad week for Robert Tufts. The 5-year-old two-term mayor of Dorset, Minnesota, population 28, who lost his re-election bid to Eric Mueller, age 16. It was fun, said Robert, who used his powers to declare ice cream the most important food group, but it's time to pass on the vote. It was a bad week for Jedi, after British officials refused to issue a passport to Laura Matthews, 29, who changed her middle name to Skywalker in 2008 and now uses the signature L. Skywalker. Officials said that her Star Wars-inspired moniker infringed a trademark. It was a bad week for the gentleman's game after police said two Pennsylvania golfers, age 42 and 63, had a violent argument over rules, specifically regarding water. Both men were taken from the seventh hole straight to the emergency room. Take a look at a few columns now. This from the U.S., Nicholas Kristof at the New York Times. Cars, guns, and sensible regulation. If our society had never taken steps to regulate cars, today we would have 715,000 Americans dying annually in vehicle accidents, said Nicholas Kristof. That calculation is made on the basis of the automobile fatality rate in 1921, a time when most Americans supported the right to travel, a widely held belief that all citizens should be free to drive cars without regulation. Early efforts to require driver's licenses and training, set speed limits, and register vehicles were met with resistance and ridicule. But once it became obvious that autos were killing and maiming people in great numbers, the courts and lawmakers took action, intelligently instituting evidence-based measures to reduce fatalities. So why can't we do the same with guns? Just as cars were made safer thanks to seatbelts, airbags, and drunk driving laws, so too could guns be made safer with common-sense safety measures such as trigger locks and background checks. Clearly, this will not eliminate all gun deaths, but if a combination of measures could reduce the toll by one-third, we could save 10,000 lives a year. The Second Amendment does not prohibit sane regulation. On this page, I'd like to read you one of the blurbs from It Must Be True, I Read It in the Tabloids. India's government has hired 40 monkey impersonators in a desperate bid to scare off the real monkeys that are terrorizing the country's parliament. Hundreds of macaques roam freely around government buildings in New Delhi, attacking bureaucrats for food and chewing through internet and phone cables. To frighten off the macaques, officials recruited a team of very talented monkey wallahs, or specialists, who will dress up as more aggressive langur monkeys and hoot and shriek at the smaller simians. It's not a bad way to earn my bread and butter, said one of the wallahs. Our second column comes from the United Kingdom. It's an editorial from the Daily Mail titled, Buy Your Way into the Lords. Is it possible for the House of Lords to get any more bloated? Asked the Daily Mail. With more than 800 members, it is already the second largest legislature in the world, behind only the Chinese National People's Congress. And now Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron, eager to woo the business community ahead of next year's elections, has decided to stuff it with still more cronies. Another 20 people are being appointed as lifetime peers and given the title Lord or Baroness, and they are almost all major donors to the various political parties. Among the Tory appointees are a millionaire businesswoman known for her turn on TV's The Apprentice and a city financier who donated $10 million to the Conservatives. One of the Labour picks is a former soap star turned member of the European Parliament, who has already pocketed vast sums of public money during 15 years on the Brussels gravy train. Ennobling such people is an embarrassment to democracy. The upper house of parliament was meant to function sagely as a check on the hyper-political commons. Instead, it is just as crass. The Lords has become little more than a retirement home for failed politicians, over-the-hill party hacks, and dodgy party donors. From the international page, we'll take the How They See Us column. Russia's blame game over Flight 17. The Russian people are being fed a pack of lies about the downing of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17, said Jonathan Eyal in the Straits Times from Singapore. All the evidence suggests that the Moscow-backed separatists blasted the passenger plane out of the sky over eastern Ukraine with a Russian-supplied missile last month, killing all 298 people on board. But most Russians believe Kiev was behind this atrocity, thanks to the conspiracy theories pumped out by state-run TV. Some newscasters claim Ukraine's military mistook the aircraft for Vladimir Putin's jet, also flying over Ukraine that day, and attacked it in an attempt to assassinate the Russian president. Another theory holds that Ukrainian separatists did hit a plane with a missile, but that the plane was the Ukrainian fighter jet that downed Flight 17. Most obscene of all is the story put out by Igor Strelkov, rebel leader of the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic, who claims the flight was loaded with corpses before it took off and was detonated over Ukraine to frame the rebels. By the time international inspectors finally established the truth, the number of claims and counterclaims will be so huge that Russians will never be convinced. By blaming this tragedy on Russia, Washington has chosen conflict over compromise in its dealings with Moscow, said Timofey Bordachev in Izvestia from Russia. But we shouldn't fear a new Cold War, because modern Russia, unlike the Soviet Union, isn't interested in global domination. All we want is minimal foreign influence along our perimeter. Sadly, conflict could be inevitable, said Georg Mizuran, an expert, also from Russia. Putin is tired of the West's failure to acknowledge his moderate position toward Ukraine. From the outset, he has offered mediation and called for a ceasefire in the country's war-torn east, only to be demonized at every turn. Now, even the European Union has caved to U.S. pressure and imposed severe sanctions on Russia. But Moscow can impose penalties, too. And Poland, Lithuania, and other EU countries that depend on trade with Russia will find their economies hit hard. In a choice between abandoning our national interests and standing up to the West, it is easy to guess which option the Russian president will choose. Putin doesn't have much of a choice, said Ivan Nekoporenko in the Moscow Times. The president's annexation of Crimea has reawakened Russian nationalism, and ideas that were once only espoused by fringe groups, such as bringing all ethnic Russians back into the motherland, have become central to Russia's political discourse. The danger is that nationalist forces can be hard to tamp down, even by a leader who unleashed them. Putin will find himself under pressure to create more and more reasons for national pride, and that could mean more military adventures. An obituary for you this week. The Reagan staffer who championed gun control. James Brady, 1940 to 2014. James Brady had been White House press secretary for less than 3 months in March 1981 when a deranged would-be assassin, John Hinckley Jr., opened fire at President Reagan outside a Washington, D.C. hotel. The president, a Secret Service agent, and a policeman were hit. but it was Brady, shot in the head, who suffered the most serious injury. A bullet ripped through his brain, partially paralyzing his left arm and left leg and impairing his short-term memory and speech. "What I was," he said, "I will never be again." Instead, Brady found a new purpose in life. As a dogged campaigner for tougher gun control legislation, including the 1993 law that bears his name. The Brady bill required handgun buyers to undergo background checks and a 5-day waiting period. "I wouldn't be here in this damn wheelchair if we had common sense legislation," he said. A veteran Republican aide, Brady started working at the White House shortly after Reagan's 1981 inauguration. Brady, nicknamed the Bear for his burly physique, had a quick wit that soon won him the admiration of the press corps, said the Washington Post. After Brady was shot, he never fully recovered physically despite multiple brain operations. Infuriated that Hinckley, who had a history of mental illness, had been able to use a fake ID to buy a $29 handgun from a pawn shop, Brady and his wife, Sarah, became impassioned and often impatient advocates for stricter gun control legislation. During a 1989 Senate hearing, he was asked whether a waiting period would unfairly inconvenience gun buyers, said the Los Angeles Times. "I need help getting out of bed, help taking a shower, and help getting dressed," he replied. "I guess I'm paying for their convenience." In 1993, President Clinton signed the Brady Handgun Violence Prevention Act into law, with Brady at his side. But the former White House staffer remained concerned that guns were still available to people with mental problems like Hinckley and continued to lobby for tighter laws, said the New York Times. Asked in 2006 if he felt bitter toward his shooter, he replied, "Well, it's not classy to be bitter, and I try to be classy." Our last Word article this week is titled "Ghosts of the Freedom Summer." "On my first visit to Mississippi," says Nicole Hannah Jones, "I discovered my family's hidden history. In 1947, my father, along with his mother and older brother, boarded a northbound train in Greenwood, Mississippi. They carried with them nothing but a suitcase stuffed with clothes, a bag of cold chicken, and my grandmother's determination that her children, my father was just 2 years old, would not be doomed to a life of picking cotton in the feudal society that was the Mississippi Delta. Grandma, as we called her, settled in Waterloo, Iowa, a stop on the Illinois Central Line and a place where thousands of black Mississippians would find work on the railroad or at the Rath meatpacking and John Deere plants. Grandma took a job familiar to black women, working for white families as a domestic. Almost every black person I knew growing up in Waterloo has roots in Mississippi. Mississippi flavored our cuisine, inspired our worship, and colored our language. Still, when speaking about the land of their birth, my dad and grandmother talked about family and loved ones, but seldom about the place. Mississippi was at once my ancestral land and the sinister setting in any number of Hollywood movies, a villain in our national narrative. The only image of Greenwood I got from my family was of my great-grandparents' farm. Scenes of chickens and picking peas in the morning sun, and my great-grandmother, Mary Jane Paul, refusing to take any mess. It was only when I got older that I learned my family did not, in fact, own the farm. Though my parents would load us all in the car every summer to head to a different state for our family vacations, my dad never once took us to the state of his birth, not for family reunions or funerals, not for graduations or holidays. As the nation prepared this year to mark the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer, that violent and heady 10 weeks during which Northern volunteers joined forces with Southern activists in Mississippi, all working to meaningfully enfranchise black residents, I felt pulled to finally visit this place that ran in my blood, but that I had never seen. This June, I visited Mississippi for the first time. My 87-year-old great-aunt, Charlotte Frost, who had followed my grandma to Waterloo, happened to be visiting a granddaughter in Jackson at the same time I planned my trip. I picked up Aunt Charlotte, and we headed north on U.S. Highway 49 toward Greenwood, into the heart of the Delta and Freedom Summer's Ground Zero. As we drove, I tried to get my Aunt Charlotte to open up about what it was like coming of age in a black family in the Delta. But she said she never had any problems with white people, and that they had respected her family and hadn't done much to bother them. It was a familiar take. She and another great aunt in Waterloo are the last of my grandmama's siblings, and I had tried before to get their stories. I never pushed too hard at this gauzy vision, because I know that women like my great aunts, they pride themselves in their durable dignity, dress to the nines, don't use vulgar language, and keep impeccable homes, have no desire to speak of the daily degradations they'd faced at the height of Jim Crow. A wooden sign coated in brown paint announced our arrival. Welcome to Greenwood, cotton capital of the world. But it was clear from the rows of lanky corn stretched out before the sign, not exactly squat June cotton, that the greeting's boast was mere nostalgia. We headed to the little Zion Missionary Baptist Church just outside of town. The plain white structure was where our family worshipped. My great-grandmother and great-grandfather, Mary Jane and Percy Paul, part of the first generation born out of slavery, are buried in the overgrown cemetery. According to Aunt Charlotte, the church used to be part of the Whittington Plantation, the white landowners having built it for the black sharecroppers. It's still surrounded by crops, and Aunt Charlotte, stooped over her cane, pointed to a distant spot in the fields, saying their house, the house where my great-grandmother helped deliver my father, once stood there on the Whittington lands. It was dusk, and the Delta heat settled about my shoulders like a wool blanket. Aunt Charlotte, wrapped in a memory, paused to listen to an owl hooting. The old people would say someone is going to die, she said. Greenwood's Yazoo River is formed by the meeting of the Tallahatchie and Yallabusha rivers, and as we crossed the Yazoo River and headed to the heart of Greenwood, the ghost of Mississippi grew close, and Aunt Charlotte finally loosened. Aunt Charlotte told me that she was baptized in the Tallahatchie. She went on to speak of another river baptism, into the perils of the Delta's color line. She said her brother Milton, my dad's namesake, and a cousin had once committed the sin of walking through a white neighborhood for a reason other than to simply go to work. Two white teenagers in a car gave chase. Her brother and cousin were forced to jump into the murky river to escape. They returned home, muddy and wet, chest heaving from panic and exertion. It was just a few miles outside of town where they found the body of Emmett Till. The tossing of black bodies into the muddy rivers for breaching the social order wasn't unusual. The only reason people across the nation knew Till's name was that his mother insisted on an open casket and allowed the ghastly photos of his mutilated corpse to be seen in the nation's leading black publications. It was eerie being down here where it happened, just a few miles from where my dad grew up, and realizing how easily he could have been Till. We somehow convince ourselves that this is ancient history, but I am not even 40, and my dad was but 4 years younger than Till. Like my dad, Till's mother had also left as one of hundreds of thousands of black Mississippians and fled their homeland during the Great Migration. The Reverend Willie Blue joined the Mississippi Civil Rights Movement in 1963. Blue, who returned home to Tallahatchie County after a stint in the Navy, had been getting pressure from whites to find work on a plantation or to get out of town. Blue instead headed to Greenwood, where he hooked up with Bob Moses. Moses, a Harvard-educated New Yorker, had come to Mississippi in 1961 to work on voter registration for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, known as the SNCC. Moses set up SNCC's headquarters in Greenwood and Blue's first task was to pick up Harry Belafonte and Sidney Poitier, who were coming to Greenwood to offer their support. Blue arrived at the airport only to encounter a cadre of armed Ku Klux Klan members. The two-car delegation picked up their Hollywood guests, and Blue soon found himself in a high-speed chase with the Klan. Laughing ruefully today, Blue said he didn't find out until later that Poitier and Belafonte had been carrying tens of thousands of dollars in cash to help the voting rights effort. Moses said the 1963 killing of Medgar Evers was the turning point. Byron De La Beckwith followed Evers home and shot him through the heart with a rifle. Evers was carrying a box of T-shirts proclaiming, "Jim Crow must go." It was time to up the ante. So the notion was hatched to recruit college students from across the country who would converge on the state for 10 weeks. The goal? To register enough disenfranchised black voters to challenge the all-white Democratic delegation at the National Convention in Atlantic City, New Jersey, and instead seat the biracial Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. Black Mississippians had attempted to desegregate schools and lunch counters, movie theaters, and swimming pools. But sit-ins to eat at the integrated restaurant were one thing. Pushing to access the vote in such a heavily black region was something else. "If we get the right to vote, we become captains of our own ship," said Blue. "I believe that then. I believe that now." The toll on black bodies during the effort to ensure voting rights is, for people of my generation, inconceivable. In the years leading up to Freedom Summer, black Mississippians agitating for civil rights were beaten by mobs, castrated, dragged behind cars with ropes, bombed. None of this was done in secret. Among the murderers were a state legislator and a county sheriff. Freedom Summer organizers calculated that for the vote push to work, a significant number of the student volunteers needed to be white. We know what they bring with them are the eyes of the country, Moses told me. The country is able to see through their eyes what they weren't able to see through ours. Of course, most everyone knows what happened next. As Freedom Summer began, three civil rights workers, Michael Schwerner and Andrew Goodman, two white Northerners, and James Earl Cheney, a black Mississippian, disappeared in Mississippi. "There is no kidnapping in Mississippi," Blue reminded me. "We knew they were dead." But the murders of those two white men changed everything. These were not just white folks. They were America's finest, America's futures, Blue said. Goodman's richer than whipped cream. He wasn't supposed to die in Vietnam. He sure wasn't supposed to die in Mississippi. When America's brightest are murdered for doing something fundamentally American, suddenly the world knows about Mississippi. It was another nail in the segregated coffin. When I drove my great aunt back to Jackson, she had casually pointed at a restaurant named Lusco's that had been in the exact location when she was a child. Of course, as a child, she'd been barred from eating there. I immediately decided that I would eat there that night. Lusco's was founded in 1921 by Italian immigrants who solidified their assimilation process by banning black diners. Five generations later, the restaurant is still owned by the same family. I stood outside and talked to the hostess who'd stepped out for a smoke. As I talked to her, a boisterous older white couple, probably in their 70s, came out. The woman was charming and seemed used to attention. I was told that everyone simply refers to her as Mrs. Greenwood. Mrs. Greenwood asked me and the photographer with me where we were from. Just then, two young black men walked by. Quietly, eyes down, they headed to the store at the corner. Mrs. Greenwood's eyes followed them, and a sneer curled her lips. "That's what you call our local color," she said. The last word, which she pronounced "kala," sounded mean and hard to my ears. Perhaps I blanched, because Miss Greenwood tried to recover. "I'm not being ugly," she said. "It's not safe here." I went back to my hotel room and wrote my notes. The Delta can be devastating. This was published in ProPublica in 2014 and condensed from the original article. Over on the health and science page, the long-term benefits of a short jog. 5 minutes a day. That, according to a new study, is all the running that's required to drastically reduce your chance of dying prematurely. Researchers examined the medical records of 55,137 American adults over a period of 15 years. They found that the 24% who described themselves as runners were 30% less likely to die of any cause during that period and 45% less likely to die of cardiovascular disease. Strikingly, this means that the mortality risk from not running, 24%, was higher than that from being overweight, 16%, having a family history of heart disease, 20%, or having high cholesterol, 6%. The researchers then split the runners into several groups, ranging from those who ran up to 50 minutes a week to those who ran for more than 175 minutes. To their surprise, they found that the benefits of running were essentially the same across all groups, and they calculated that as little as 30 to 59 minutes of running a week was enough to significantly reduce the risk of premature death. Most people can fit in 5 minutes a day of running, study co-author Timothy Church tells the New York Times. The benefits in terms of mortality are remarkable. Learning to smell fear. Why do children sometimes suffer chronic nightmares or even flashbacks to events they never experienced? The key, according to a new study, is odor, specifically the smell of fear. Researchers conditioned a group of non-pregnant rats to fear the smell of peppermint using small electric shocks. When these rats later gave birth, their pups also exhibited signs of increased stress when exposed to the peppermint aroma. Further tests revealed that the fear-induced odor emitted by their mothers could trigger the same stress response in the pups, including an increase of the stress hormone cortisol. The scientists, led by Jacek Debiak from the University of Michigan, said that while these maternal cues are an integral part of the offspring's ability to adapt to its environment, mothers who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorders or pathological fears could potentially pass those fears on to their children. Understanding these intergenerational transmissions could lead to breakthroughs in therapeutic treatment and prevention methods. Our research demonstrates that infants can learn from maternal expressions of fear very early in life, Debiak told the Daily Telegraph. Before they can even make their own experiences, they basically acquire their mother's experiences. On the Talking Points page now, Nixon, Watergate revisited 40 years later. It's time to cut Tricky Dick a break, said John Aloysius Farrell in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. To mark the 40th anniversary of the disgraced president's resignation, HBO this week broadcast a documentary containing new clips from the secret White House recording system that led to his downfall. Laid bare are Nixon's virulent anti-Semitism, his relentless paranoia, and his single-minded desire for political survivor. I want it done on a thievery basis, he directs aides on the retrieval of documents from the Brookings Institution. God damn it, get in and get those files. Blow the safe and get it. Yet as much as Nixon deserved his disgrace, history shouldn't forget his achievements. Abroad, he did end the Vietnam War and opened the door to China. At home, he ended the draft, gave 18-year-olds the vote, and helped desegregate Southern schools. As Bill Clinton said in Nixon's 1994 funeral, the 37th president should not be judged on anything less than his entire life and career. It seems to have become fashionable to measure Nixon by coffee spoons, said David Shribman in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. A dollop of disgrace balanced by a splash of brilliance. But such revisionism makes light of Nixon's shockingly amoral use of power. He left the country deeply disillusioned and poisoned our civic life with a cynicism that remains an American contaminant. Even though 60 of Nixon's aides and allies were convicted of crimes, we still don't know the full extent of his activities, said Bob Woodward in the Washington Post. Charles Colson, Nixon's special counsel, was recorded bragging to him that he'd engaged in blackmail and a hell of a lot of things you never read about, saying he'd take his worst secrets to the grave. That he did. So, undoubtedly, did Nixon. If Watergate happened today, said Ruth Marcus, also in the Washington Post, would the outcome be the same? Probably not. Americans are now accustomed to trusting only media that confirm their pre-existing political dispositions and wouldn't be able to discern a genuine scandal. And what about Congress? Back in 1974, Senate Republicans joined Democrats in plumbing the depths of Watergate and forcing Nixon from office. Would a modern-day Congress stop a modern-day Nixon? Or would a partisan simply defend their president? I think we can guess. And along those political lines, another talking point article, impeachment. The Democrats dare. I've just received a frantic email from Democratic House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, said Jonah Goldberg in the Los Angeles Times. I need your urgent support, she pleaded, explaining that congressional Republicans are now suing President Obama, opening the door to impeachment. This is pure nonsense. House Speaker John Boehner has repeatedly said that Republicans have no plans to impeach Obama. But with transparent glee, Pelosi and other Democrats are flooding their liberal base with fundraising appeals, claiming that if Republicans win the Senate in November's midterm election, Obama will almost certainly be driven from office. Democrats are, in fact, practically begging for the Republicans to impeach him, said John Fund in NationalReview.com. It's a sign of their desperation, as polls show the GOP likely to ride voter disenchantment to a majority midterm victory. On the lefty MSNBC network, impeachment is raised, on average, every 22 minutes. If impeachment is a scam, said David Weigel in Slate.com, it was started on the right. Since Representative Darrell Issa, Republican from California, began using the I word in 2010, several high-profile Republicans, including Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma, Representative Jim Sassenbrenner of Wisconsin, Newt Gingrich, and Sarah Palin, have eagerly jumped on the bandwagon, accusing Obama of high crimes and misdemeanors over gun control, Benghazi, immigration, and more. A conservative website is handing out bumper stickers that read, "Honk for impeachment." By suing Obama for supposedly overstepping his authority, Boehner has fed the latest round of impeachment talk, said Leslie Savon in TheNation.com. Rather than placating the Tea Party crazies, he succeeded only in getting them more stirred up and demanding more than a mere lawsuit. Still, by daring Republicans to impeach Obama, the White House is playing with fire, said Joe Klein in Time.com. Obama is saying he will issue a major executive order over immigration later in the summer, given that Congress can't pass any form of immigration reform. But if Obama does go for broke on the border, conferring legal status to millions of undocumented workers, there might be no stopping the primal fury unleashed among hardline conservatives. Yes, it might be a canny political strategy for Obama to encourage the GOP to surrender to its extremist wingnuts, but do we really need to raise the heat in a country that is already brain-fried by partisan frenzy? And a few notes as we wind down the hour. So far, the current Congress has enacted 142 laws, the fewest of any Congress in the past two decades. Only 108 of the bills passed were substantive pieces of legislation, while the remaining 34 dealt with renaming post offices, anniversary commemorations, and other ceremonial issues. The Federal Aviation Administration has told U.S. airlines not to fly over Iraq unless their planes are at an altitude of at least 30,000 feet, citing the potentially hazardous situation there. Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 was at 33,000 feet when it was shot down in Ukraine. Back in 1996, nuclear power provided 17.6% of the world's electricity. Today, that's down to 10.8%. The largest cause for the drop is the Fukushima disaster in 2011, after which 48 nuclear reactors in Japan and 8 in Germany were shut down. Buoyed by nostalgia and a new generation of fans, sales of vinyl records in the U.S. increased from 1 million in 2007 to 6.1 million last year. Though vinyl still accounts for only about 2% of the total album sales, music executives say the format won't disappear anytime soon. In the poll watch, 69% of Americans think that Central American migrant children should be allowed to stay in the U.S. if it's unsafe for them to return home. 27% of Americans think they should be deported. And how about a quote from Bill Cosby, quoted in the Tampa Tribune? Through humor, you can soften some of the worst blows that life delivers. And once you find laughter, no matter how painful your situation might be, you can survive it. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast on our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.